You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Steven R. Poff.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Before we get started, I'd like to thank some sponsors for making the show possible. Patricia Gillum, World Gone Red, her new short story, Heroes of Corvus, Book 2, a sequel to A Superhero's Duty. Daniel Spires reveals to his team and Icarus that someone has been mass abducting the children of modern heroes and villains around the world. Icarus searches for answers while dealing with the physical aftermath of his encounter with Hellstorm. His powers are fading, and a compromised hero may cost him his life. This is an excellent new series from Patricia Gillum. There's going to be more coming soon. Stay tuned for it. Get in on the series while it's unfolding. Patricia Gillum, World Gone Red, Heroes of Corvus, Book 2. I'd also like to thank Richard Fox and his Ember War Saga. Guys, if you love science fiction the way I do, you must read the Ember War Saga. 9 books with several spinoffs, lots of great stuff going on in the Ember War. This one, and if you love audio, let me tell you, Luke Daniels narrates the audio for this series, and it is absolutely amazing. We're going to be talking about the Ember War Saga more in coming episodes, but go check it out on Amazon, The Ember War Saga by Richard Fox. Now on to our great show. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am really excited to have Steven R. Donaldson on the show with me today. He has a fantastic new book that just came out yesterday. It's called The War Within, the second book in the Great Gods War series. Welcome to the show, Mr. Donaldson.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I'm excited to have you. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
That is a complicated question. I did not discover the ambition to write stories down until I was in freshman orientation at college, which I found an enormously exciting experience, and people around me were very intelligent and talented, and I was thrilled, and I wanted to do something that made sense to me. But in terms of being a storyteller, I can tell you in retrospect that I started training to do this work when I was about 4 years old. All my stories are long and complicated, if you've read any of them.
I have.
My family were medical missionaries in India, and we moved to India when I was 4. I found that experience personally very traumatic for a 4-year-old, and my parents were not of the kind of people who were any good at helping children deal with emotional turmoil and distress. And I was in a great deal of distress until I started, totally unselfconsciously, telling myself internal stories. And they took the form that you know, many kids do. I developed an imaginary friend. And my imaginary friend, though, performed a very specific function. He was the brave companion who helped little me cope with what, from my perspective, were superhero-style crises. They were, well, I was 4. They were cosmic. They were world-shattering. They were horrible in all kinds of ways. And my friend was the one of the two of us who led the way in meeting these challenges and and finding a way to rise above them. This became such an important part of my internal life that as I slowly grew older, I began trying consciously to improve the effectiveness of the stories that I was telling inside my head about myself and my imaginary friend. And I made a number of precocious discoveries, one of which is that stories are more believable if you tell them in the past tense, because that implies that they've already happened. And so my stories I told myself shifted into the past tense. Then I discovered that since I still knew that I was I was 6 or 7 or 8 years old, but I was a small kid in a terrifying situation with a support system that was not responsive to my emotional needs. I discovered that stories are actually more plausible if you tell them about somebody else. And so I began telling my stories about myself in the third person. Third person past tense. I refer to myself as Donaldson, and I was Donaldson in my own mind, mostly through college. I didn't call myself Steve. I called myself Donaldson in the privacy of my own mind. So I was in training. I was in training for the day when I discovered that stories would be even better if they were written down. Because when you're only telling them in your head and you have a particular emotional goal or support or comfort or affirmation that you're trying to create, you pretty much have to start from the beginning in order to build the circumstances that lead to that. And when you're just doing it in your own head, you're forever starting at the beginning. And it's hard to get to the part of the story that you're really striving for. If you write it down, you don't have to do all that again. So I started writing novellas as a freshman in college. Started in the college orientation, and with the usual ups and downs that happen to people, I basically never wavered in my aspiration to be a person who made his way in the world by writing stories down.
That's amazing. Those are awfully keen observations for a young guy to have picked up the past tense and the third person. Those are things that that a lot of writers never think about, or at least the why of why we tell stories the way we do. It seems to me that you are a storyteller, and that these things have just always been important to you. You mentioned that your family were not exactly helpful in helping you to adjust, but were they encouraging of storytelling? Were you surrounded by books? I think I heard a story one time of you coming upon the Chronicles of Narnia and knowing that you were going to have to give those books back, reading through a haircut, I think, if I remember right. Were you surrounded by books and stories?
Well, you understand, we are in India, it's the mission field, they don't even have telephones, we certainly didn't have television. So India, even at that time, had a thriving movie industry, but they're all Indian movies. Eventually, the boarding school I attended began bringing in 2 or 3 movies a year from old ones from the U.S., which they would play for the school, and so I got exposed to movies in that way, but pretty much it was books. Missionaries as a group read the Bible, of course. They read Time magazine. They read Reader's Digest. And they read mystery novels. And there were always books around. By the time I got to high school, I was working my way through all the fun stuff in the school library. But, yes, I discovered the Narnia books by accident, visiting a different missionary family who happened to have them, and I was going to have to leave them behind when we went back home. That was pretty exciting. But mostly I was reading what in those days were commonly considered adventure books for boys. They ranged from, you know, Dave Dawson, World War II Fighting Ace, to A Bomb at the Jungle Boy, to the Tom Swift and Tom Swift Jr. books, and there was one about a commercial pilot in the United States who did things like deliver the mail and rescue people from strange places. There was a whole long series. Like the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew, these were works for hire. The author's name was always the same, but they had entire teams of people who were actually writing the books, so there were a lot of them. And I read and read and read them all. And when I was not at boarding school, I read whatever my parents and their other missionary parents had lying around, which sometimes went to the extreme of Leon Uris, and other times, my mother did try to get me to read abstract theology, but I couldn't get into it. So yes, lots and lots of reading of books, and lots and lots of getting into the habit of thinking in terms of stories. Stories eventually became my most useful tool for understanding myself, but I also discovered that hearing stories was the only way I could learn to understand other people. And so it became a core value, storytelling.
Well, and it shows in your writing in that In your first series, the Thomas Covenant series, Thomas Covenant is a writer who finds himself in interesting times. Your new series, one of the there's a library that features prominently in the story, and the story kind of hinges around this library. There's this undercurrent in your writing of the importance of story, even, you know, the story within the story. Is that something that is conscious to you as you're writing, or is this just kind of the core value, as you say, you know, the storytelling is a core value?
Well, you have to understand it's a core value. That means it's a core for each character I write about. And it's important that each character I write about, each important character I write about, has their own story. And so there are, of course, many stories within the story. One of the things that I pride myself on is being true to the individual stories of the characters, and yet finding ways to have their stories catalyze or energize the stories of the characters around them so that they form a combined and organic story. But within that, each one of those people, they are not a mechanism that exists for the author's purposes. They are, I mean, this is how I think of them. They are people who do things for their own reasons, because of what's happened to them, and because of what they care about, and each of those is distinct from the other important characters in the story. So on that level, I'm always thinking about stories within stories.
You published your first book in the Thomas Covenant series in 1977, is that right?
That is correct.
That was a really interesting time for fiction and for fantasy, especially. It was really, really the birth of our modern fantasy age, if you will. Terry Brooks, that with the Shannara series coming out around that time, a lot of things that were coming into maturity. Then we had Tolkien before that, Lewis, but this real fantasy industry that we have now was really birthed around that time. Where did the idea for Thomas Covenant come from? Because we have these other high fantasy series, but you come with it with a completely different approach in that it's a portal fantasy, which had not really been done in a serious way, the way that you did it. And Thomas Covenant himself is a character that had not really been done before. I think I heard someone say that you did Grimdark before Grimdark was a thing, and kind of tongue in cheek. But Thomas Covenant was a completely different character that we had not seen before.
Well, you're basically asking me two separate questions. One of which is the story of publishing and what was happening at that time in the publishing industry. And the story of me. My background of study up until a certain point in my life was serious mainstream literature. I was an English major in college. I was an English major in graduate school. If I had stayed to finish a PhD, I would have worked on the novels of Joseph Conrad. I aspired, in my own way, to be Joseph Conrad. But toward the end of my junior year in college, I read Lord of the Rings. And I was ecstatic. In fact, the reason I did not make Phi Beta Kappa as a college student was because I didn't study for some of my exams. At the end of my junior year, I was reading Lord of the Rings, and that was way more important than whether I passed college German or things like that. Reading Lord of the Rings at that time, which is in the mid-60s, on the one hand, those books were selling a million sets a year. They were everywhere, but not in the intellectual world of people who studied serious literature. It was common then for people to think that this is adolescent wish fulfillment or nostalgia wish fulfillment on the part of Tolkien, and that it was a fad, and eventually it would fade away. I knew they were wrong, but I couldn't find anybody who would possibly agree with me. So I thought, well, if I ever get the chance, I want to write a fantasy story. But for me, ideas for stories are not something that I cobble together off wish fulfillment. I experience them as gifts which are given to me, and if I am not given the gift of an idea for a story, I don't really have any idea what to write about. So it was after college and after graduate school that I was struck by, Patricia McKillop calls it the tail of the comet, the moment when it seems like the world inside your head turns to fire and you get incredibly excited about an idea. I had the idea of writing about the character in a large fantasy who must confront at that point, the idea was a Sauron-type figure, a pure evil guy, and has the courage to do that because ultimately he denies the reality of evil. His only strength is that he doesn't believe in it. Well, I'm This is a tale of a comet. It was very exciting. There were no characters attached to it. There was no plot attached to it. There was no context attached to it. It was just a concept. And so it sat there in my head for years. And then one day, a little bit of backstory. My father was an orthopedic medical missionary, and as an orthopedist, one of his duties was as the chief medical officer for the local leprosarium. Now, my father was an orthopedist because he wanted to fix stuff. And he was very good at fixing stuff, and he had a lot of success and developed quite a reputation throughout Southeast Asia for what he could accomplish as an orthopedist. But you can't fix leprosy. So for the only time that I know of in his life, my father became emotionally involved in the dilemma of what having leprosy is like. Still a missionary in India. I was in the United States. On his last visit to the United States from India, one of the things missionaries got to do is go around to churches and raise money. And my father was not a preacher, he was a physician. And so what he did when he came to a church and was asked to speak was he talked about his work. On a particular Sunday that I heard him, he was talking about his work with lepers. And while he was talking, I was thinking, if I want to write a big story about somebody who disbelieves, I should write about somebody who has every conceivable reason to prefer belief. If you have a good life and you have a nightmare and you wake up and you say, thank God that nightmare is over, that's normal. But if your life is a nightmare and you haven't experienced that's a glorious dream and you wake up and you still say, I can tell the difference, that's a dream. I know what reality is. That's not self-interest. That's a statement about the nature of importance, a nature of what matters and why it matters, and whose life could possibly be more like a nightmare than a leper's. Well, as soon as I hit that, you know, I spent the next 4 months drawing maps, planning characters, outlining my intentions, and then I was ready to start writing. So we ended up with a protagonist who's a leper, who's called the unbeliever, because he insists that what's happening to him is a dream, and he knows the difference. And gradually, he learns to discover what real importance is. And what he learns, of course, is that importance comes from within him. It doesn't matter whether the land, his fantasy world, is real or not. What matters is that he cares about it, that he's willing to sacrifice himself for it. And that is the most important revelation of the First Chronicles.
That had to be a revolutionary thought at the time.
Nobody around me who would have backed me up.
Right. Well, and speaking of that, you were working with the Del Reys as your publisher at the time. Is that right?
Well, that it became right.
It became, yes. Yeah. What was the and you've talked about the kind of split with literary fiction and the what we would now refer to as genre fiction. Was there this kind of groundswell of support for genre fiction then and seeing that these books that are not considered standard mainstream literary fiction, that they could tell important stories, and that we could wrestle with deep, meaningful topics while still entertaining people and not being the kinds of books that you have to drudge through 8 times before you ever start to glean any meaning from it?
Ulysses leaps to mind.
Yeah, James Joyce was a, yeah, he was a struggle.
Yeah, he was a long, slow read. This is the story of publishing. Lord of the Rings was massively popular. In the 60s, every publisher launched a fantasy department. In one way or another, they all failed. They couldn't sell books. They were all taking a kind of a condescending approach to the nature of the material they were publishing. You know, no matter how much you happen to love Conan the Barbarian, he is going to have limited appeal to a wide audience. Ballantine Books had an adult fantasy series edited by a guy named Lynn Carter, who was mostly interested in feathering his own nest. And he dug out of print, out of copyright, old fantasies, published them in an adult fantasy series. Well, the reason they had gone out of print and they were not heard of before, they were turgid and dull. And he finally got in trouble when, unbeknownst to him, he actually stole Evangeline Walton's Mabie Allen and Ogeon books for the adult fantasy series. And she wrote a very polite letter to the publisher saying, "Gee, I didn't know you were doing this." And after that, Ballantine didn't want to go down this road anymore. Eventually, all the publishing programs failed. Science fiction was still a niche market. Firing everybody else, he added Betty Ballantine, who were running Ballantine Books, hired Judy Lynn Del Rey to be their science fiction editor. And Judy Lynn was married to Lester, and Lester made her a bet. He said, "I'll bet I can create a fantasy publishing program which title for title will outsell your science fiction." So she took him up on it. He was not one of the staff at Ballantine. It was a nepotism issue. He was an outside consultant. Well, his very first discovery was Terry Brooks. Now, the very first part of Terry Brooks' book, The Sword of Shamrock, is a direct ripoff of Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
If you sit down and analyze the plot, it has all the same events in the same order with the same characters in the same situation.
Right.
It just isn't very well done. But it exploded in the marketplace. 300,000 trade paperback originals in the first month.
Insane numbers.
And people are saying, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God." And Lester said, "Well, I have something else to offer you," because in the interval he had discovered the Chronicles of Thomas Cumming. And so the very next books to arrive on the market were the Chronicles of Thomas Cumming. And Judy Lynn, who was a publishing genius, persuaded Holt Reinhart and Winston, a literary publisher, mainstream literary publisher, to publish all three books of the trilogy on the same day. Massive attention was paid. It was probably reviewed in every newspaper in the United States. This publishing event changed the industry. You know, within a year, all the other publishers had fantasy programs again. Lester's, for a while, went from success to success. And the second Chronicles, made history for a U.S. writer of fantasy in terms of its success and stuff. And then doors opened for many, many different writers, and publishers became receptive in a whole new way to the idea of publishing fantasy. And the world became a different place.
The Thomas Covenant series went on to be 10 books in total. Is that right?
That is correct.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Not meaning to be arrogant, but I call it my Sistine Chapel because it's that big.
Right. And has been so important in the fantasy space. I think lots of other writers have built upon what you started, and I think would readily admit that.
Well, I know for a number of them, some yes, some no.
You're right, right. You also dipped into science fiction with the Gap Cycle. When writing science,
dipping.
Well,
that's five books.
It is five books. Five big books. Do you approach science fiction differently than you do fantasy? Do you see them as different art forms? Is it just a matter of window dressing? How do you approach writing those when shifting from one to the other?
Well, if you look broadly across my body of work, taking Covenant as one example, the Gap books as another, the Mirror Over Dreams fantasy as another, the story I'm writing as another, the mystery novels that I write as another, what they all have in common is that they create completely different worlds. Because different worlds imply different characters. Different kinds of characters. Different kinds of characters imply different kinds of prose. That's necessary to describe them. The characters interact a different way as expressions of the world in which they live. It is desperately important to me, since I talked about respecting the integrity of the inner stories of each of my characters, since they are all expressions of their world, it's really important to me that I change how I write about them and how they interact with each other to fit the context in which they have evolved. And it isn't a question. I mean, they talk so much, publishers particularly like to talk about a writer who has a voice. And what that seems to mean is they make every story sound the same. Stories may be different, but they're all written the same. It probably works against me that mine are all written differently. The elaborate, operatic prose that characterizes the Chronicles of Thomas Covenant is nowhere in evidence in the other stories that I have written. The kind of baroque and fulsome character that I created in a novella called The Augur's Gambit is completely absent from, say, my mystery novels, which are also first-person narration and which are intended to be set in a believable simulacrum of the real world. I change what I do to play fair with the stories I'm telling, and it starts with the world, the context. That necessitates. So writing science fiction required a completely different set of narrative skills because of the nature of the story I was telling, for example. I had to change points of view at practically every chapter. If you look at Covenant, and even Morden's Need, there are very few switches in point of view. The Gap books jump all over that known section of the galaxy in which the story occurs. Different characters, different stories, different ways of thinking. You have to basically reinvent the world every time you switch points of view. That was a new and challenging experience for me. But it was very important to me. I believed in doing it. And, well, I classic. I've said all I need to say on that.
When you're writing a world for as long as you did with Thomas Covenant, or even The Gap with five books there, it would seem that the world becomes very familiar to you as the writer, and the world building isn't as much of a chore because there's so many rules that are already established and places and things that people are familiar with. When you start a new series like The Great Gods War, is it intimidating to have to start all over again? Or do you find that writing in the same world for too long gets confining and stifling?
Well, I do not find writing in the same world confining and stifling. I do find it, the way I put it, is that I've never tackled anything big that I already knew how to write. Now, within the Covenant Chronicles, that's true because the nature of the themes and the conflicts and the interactions of the characters is something I haven't done before. But when I switch to a different world and different characters, it requires a whole new skill set. Now, I was extremely reluctant to undertake the trilogy I'm working on now because I'm not a young man. It's a huge amount of work, and it constantly requires skills that I have never demonstrated to myself that I possess. It relies heavily on me being able to do new things. I don't do it because it requires me to do new things. I do it because it's a story, and it came to me to be written, and it's my job to write it. But there are times when I tear my hair because of the things that each new story asks of me. And that was just true of the last Chronicles of Thomas Covenant, as it was of the Gap books, and as it is of the Great Gods War. It's asking me to do stuff that I don't know how to do, and so I'm going to have to learn.
And that's the job of the writer in one sense is to keep growing with the stories, and that's where the magic keeps coming from, I think.
Well, I would like to think so, but of course the world is full of many different writers and many different readers, and
sure.
Not everybody shares the same aspiration, nor
sure.
should they.
Right. Do you feel like that readers' expectations and their sensibilities have changed that much since you began writing? Can you tell the same kinds of stories in 2019 that you could in the 1960s or 70s? What, as a writer, do you have to do to keep evolving and moving forward and meeting readers' expectations?
Well, I don't think I succeed at meeting readers' expectations. My career has been a process of steadily losing writers with each new project I take on. So, I mean, losing readers. I am not, in that sense, in tune with the world I live in. I am writing for the same reasons I write. I write with the same... I mean, I want to use the words moral imperative, which has to do with the ethic of writing. It doesn't have to do with, you know, imposing morality or preaching morality to anybody else. But the world in which the qualities that I offer are valued has changed. And, of course, in many ways I've changed, you know. When I watch a movie that I thought was absolutely glorious in 1977, it seems very slow to me because, like everybody else, my attention span for filmed entertainment has not just speeded up, but it's broken up with all the cuts and switches of sight. They stop in the middle of a fight scene and show you another fight scene, and they stop in the middle of that to show you another fight scene. And, you know, I'm aware that my own sensibilities have been affected by this. it's natural in a world in which mass entertainment is infinitely more available than it was at the time when I got started writing, that the desires and expectations of the broad public would change. And it's clear that, I think if you give my stories a chance, they're very exciting. But they do kind of ask you to stop and think. And that's not the world we're living in. That's life. I was very lucky. I came along at a time when the world was ready for the stuff I had to offer. Now the world is ready for different things that other people have to offer. This is not exactly a tragedy, but it is demonstrable that the world I live in does not find what I do as satisfying as it used to.
Well, with your new series, this is a very different series than Thomas Covenant, obviously. The new book, The War Within, the second in the Great God's War trilogy, you talked about that idea of watching your father struggle with being someone who is a fixer up against a problem that can't be fixed, and that was one of the instigating factors that brought Thomas Covenant to you. What was the thing that brought the Great God's War into your imagination?
I will have an easier time talking about this when the whole story is done and I can look back on it as a whole. I got started, I wanted to write about a library. And that is, I consider that a hot topic in the modern world. We live in a world in which not just anti-intellectualism, but religious and political fanaticism has become far more front and center than it was 40 years ago when I started writing. What do the Islamic terrorists want? If they could, they want to eliminate science and technology from the world. They want to break apart anything that doesn't produce their society. What do religious fundamentalists in the United States want? They want ignorance. They want people to believe the Bible because God says it's true. And anything, stem cell research. What horror. These are horrors. What did the Chinese pirates do every time they started a new dynasty? They destroyed the libraries. Same thing happened to the Ottoman Empire. Eventually the Ottoman Empire became a place that valued its own knowledge, but they sure wanted to destroy everybody else's. Knowledge as a desirable thing is under attack in our world from all sides. Just look at our political circumstances. We want to erase the notion of facts from our political discourse. We want to believe things because so-and-so said they're true, not because they have any basis in the real world. So I wanted to write about a library under threat. This is a version of a portal story, I wanted a character who had no experience of these things to have to go and discover it. And at the same time, this is with the Chronicles of Thomas Covenant, I was become very interested in the many different roles that anger can play in a personality as a cover-up for grief and fear are the two that lead to mind most obviously. They can cover up love. It can cover up lots of other things. People use anger because somehow or another counterattacking is safer than confronting yourself. So I wanted that it seemed pretty natural. Okay, so why is the guy so angry? Well, because his country is about to be destroyed. Okay, that seemed pretty obvious. Okay, why is his country about to be destroyed? Well, blah, blah, blah. Why hasn't it been destroyed already? Well, blah, blah, blah. But there are, you know, there are things that have to, they can't survive without. So he goes on a quest. And that process of this guy, and many people have told me how unlikable Prince Byfault is in Seventh Testament. You know, I feel all warm and fuzzy when I hear that, because it sounds an awful lot like Thomas Covenant and Angus Thermopylae. I must be on the right track. And then, because the nature of what the pre-existing conditions are, you know, the story requires a time break. 40 years passed between Seventh Testament and the War Within, and that, in effect, is where the most important world building occurs, because you can't, in a story as self-contained as Seventh Testament, you can't get to all the reasons why this struggle matters. So I've got a bunch of backstory in the War Within, and I had a chance to develop my themes, and that was what I needed.
How has the technology of writing changed the way you approach the craft in the last 40 years? I'm assuming in the beginning you probably were writing on a typewriter.
Yes.
And now I assume you probably don't. Has the technology around writing affected the way you write?
Well, physically, no, because I'm still sitting at a keyboard. It has made, first off, the writing process far more efficient. When I wrote the First Chronicles of Thomas Covenant, I personally typed 27 reams of paper. It's amazing how much time the computer saves me. Now all I have to do is type the changes. Because of that efficiency, I rewrite more often. I am more stringent in how I look at my own prose, because I know it's not going to set me back 4 months having to type an entirely new draft. So there's that. Gradually, the changes have spread. You know, publishers were still doing a version of manual typesetting when I first got in. I mean, the guy wasn't physically picking up an L and placing it in I forget what the trays that held the print were called, but placing it in there and then picking up an S. And they, you know, they had an automation thing which allowed the guy at the printer to type the book and have it eventually become print. Computer typesetting has made, by increments, a really dramatic difference in how the business works. In practice, this means that publishers introduce many fewer typos than they used to. When my publisher is working from not my physical manuscript, but my digital file, you get much more accurate results. And of course, it's easier for them to catch my inaccuracies because they haven't created any of their own. And so that process is smoother and less stressful than it was years and years and years ago. Those are both important changes in, you know, how I function as a writer.
The new book is called The War Within, The Great God's War, book two of the trilogy. Are you actively working on the final installment now?
That's correct.
The how many pages do you think this trilogy will wind, or how many words will this wind up being in the end?
Well, I'm never very good at estimating that. For me, the Seventh Decimate is very short. You know, it's about 80,000 words. The War Within is closer to 250,000. I can't predict what's going to happen in the last book, but I would be astonished if it were shorter than The War Within. I think it's likely to be longer, since I have so much ground to cover and so many new skills to learn. So, you know, Seventh Decimate is not what my loyal readers have come to expect from me, you know, a doorstopper. But the story will become very much what I'm known for in terms of, you know, heft and complexity and emotional seriousness and diversity of characters and extravagance of action.
I love the idea of every project as a learning experience. And like you said earlier, that you've never tackled anything that you were fully prepared to do. That seems to be important to you, that plowing you know, new land and discovering new things as you go.
Well, it is, of course. And as a reader, it's important to me when writers do that. You know, I feel like it shows in a book when a writer is writing work that they already know how to write. Partly because at a certain point in the story, they seem to lose interest in it, and it starts to fall flat. If we were in the business here of critiquing other people's books, which we are not, you know, it would be easy to point to examples. If you aren't pushing yourself, you're not doing as much as you can, and in some sense, your mind and your talent is going to waste.
You mentioned earlier the idea of a protagonist that are, shall we say, complex, and maybe not immediately likable. To some people, or do things that are questionable and like we as real humans struggle with the light and dark side of all of us. You know, we live in a time where people are not always comfortable with characters being too complex, and even to the point that we now have people that are teaching screenwriters and novelists how to make a character immediately likable by having them rescue a cat in the opening scene of a movie or book, and there's a whole how do you deal with that, with staying true to the kind of characters that you want, but knowing that that sometimes people don't like that and don't want to do the emotional work to go along with the character?
Well, I mean, it's not like I don't find that particular detail difficult to deal with, because I couldn't write any other way. For me, I need to do what I am doing, regardless of whether it suits the spirit of the times or the spirit of the audience or not. I see other people doing it, and I cannot help noticing over the course of the story the loss of emotional impact and resonance that comes from simplistic thinking. Yes, you make him instantly likable, but then two-thirds of the way through the book, you know, and he just can't care. Oh, I know he's hanging from the edge of the cliff by his fingernails, but I think I'll go get a cup of coffee. All of these things involving presenting write the kinds of characters I do serve the purpose of making the story more and more and more gripping as you go along. And you, the further you get into it, the more you actually care, and the more the people in it feel real. The kind of suspense you get by startling people is a cheap trick. The kind of suspense you get from making the readers or the audience care about the characters and what happens to them is very different. It's harder to achieve, but it's worth a lot more when you do achieve it.
Well said. Well said. The new book, The War Within, The Great God's War, Book 2, is out, available everywhere now. Mr. Donaldson, if people want to learn more about you, dig into your back catalog, see what's going on, is there a place online where they can connect with you?
I have a website, StephenRDonaldson.com. There is hidden away, there are thousands of pages of content on that website. Of course, there's a complete bibliography. There are some free downloadable PDFs, mostly things that I have written about fantasy and about writing. But also, with every book, I make the prologue available on my website for people who want to give it a try before they commit. It's free. But if you dig in, there's a lot of interviews there, and if you go to something called The Gradual Interview, which was directly conducted between me and the people who read the website, I answered something like 2,500 questions on virtually every subject. A lot of them were about Thomas Covenant, a lot of them were about the process of storytelling, a lot of them were about other books, other situations. Prints out a hell of a lot of material. But it's free, it's accessible, it's searchable, and it's there.
Excellent. Mr. Donaldson, it has been a great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
I'm happy to do it. Thank you for your interest.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to HankGarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
The ancient building wore the severe cassock colors of a Puritan minister, a uniform monochrome of slate-gray shingles and soot-gray clapboards, its shadowed upper windows cross-hatched like the facets of a spider's eye. The second story protruded beyond the first and bore the house's only ornament, two gray teardrops of wood, weeping from each corner of the building's stiff upper lip. The place would have looked sinister and foreboding in its shadowed alley if not for the die-cut silhouette of a dancing sheep, jaunty above the door, and the two front bay windows that blazed with colorful, welcoming light. The windows were hung with orbs of colored glass on staggered lengths of ribbon. Each orb glowed with autumnal reds and delicate greens, burgundy tints and pumpkin hues, dappled raspberry and clover lime, streaked with light and weightless as bubbles over a cauldron. The shelves below offered crystal skulls and silver daggers and horny devils, Celtic chalices and woven dream catchers in dreamcoat hues. A primitive broom leaned in a corner, ready for flight, and a rhapsodic nude in bronze clutched her goat-legged lover beneath a jackal bust of Anubis. The interior of the shop was even witchier. Above a crude and sooty fireplace, a stack of brick barely holding the shape of a chimney pushed through the barn-high roof, threading ancient beams that crisscrossed overhead. Brooms and kettles and Christmas lights dangled from these, alongside Halloween costumes and Chinese umbrellas, pointy hats and bundles of herbs. Jason wandered deeper into the shop. His fingers trailed across strange bronze statuary and Aztec masks of turquoise and lapis lazuli. He rolled his eyes at the luck candles and money charms, but goggled indecently at a nude and anatomically correct silver nymph with long golden hair that reminded him of Kate.
"See anything you like?"
Jason jumped, turned, and jumped again. The woman standing before him was the living embodiment of every hippy-dippy counterculture type he'd ever seen. Her hair was green, her face pale and round, her doughy body wrapped in some elaborately woven ethnic garb. Her eyebrows were black and pierced in little rows, and her eyes were heavily circled with midnight blue, as if she'd been sucker-punched by an oil slick. She tapped the glass over the nymph.
"Admiring the goddess, I see."
Oh, she'd practically caught him with porn. "You want to hold her? She won't break. Here." The woman flipped open a glass door and handed Jason the naked figure.
"See how heavy she is? You could bang her against the wall all day and barely make a dent."
She waggled her eyebrows, obviously enjoying his discomfort. He checked the price tag.
$700? "The goddess is a symbol of love and fertility. Don't be ashamed of desiring her."
The woman's long green fingernails plucked a long black cigarette from a long red case, and she lit it.
"I sense,"
she blew smoke and studied its whorls,
"dissatisfaction in love. Yes, I have just the thing."
She pulled Jason into a side room where the smell of her clove smoke gave way to the skunky aromas of potpourri sachets, tea leaves, and hanging clutches of twiggy flowers. She searched, found a little bundle, and pressed it into his hand.
"This will make you irresistible. Rub it on your nethers twice a day, and love shall surely find you."
Jason made a face. The bundle smelled like cow manure. He didn't even want that on his hands.